Welcome to the Closer and Closer podcast, a podcast about expanding your creative capacity. Each week, we interview inspiring creatives to help you grow your freelance career. All right, let's get into the episode. Welcome to the Closer and Closer podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Andrea Mejia Madriz, and I am a part of the Artist Marketing and Partnerships team here at Closer and Closer. And we're back this week with my always wonderful co-host, Dave Arcade.
Thanks, Andrea. I'm Dave Arcade, an artist on the Closer and Closer roster, but enough about me because it is my pleasure to introduce today's guest. Jennifer is a mildly tortured artist. She's interested in the strategy behind good branding decisions. Besides business as usual, she's fond of clanging on her piano, Googling symptoms for her ailing plants, falling under Netflix's spell, and singing pitchy Waylon songs while driving her old Discovery with the windows down. She's the co-author of Freelance and Business and Stuff with her sister Amy, and a co-founder of the Southern California creative meetup Connecting Things from Chutzpah Design. I'm wildly excited to introduce the legendary Jen Hood. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Wow. Woo! That was a fabulous intro, which I did not write, I swear. Dave stayed up all night just, you know, toiling over that intro.
Well, you made me do 17 revisions, so you're like, no.
Right. We need more gravitas, Dave. Don't you get it?
Yeah.
I've actually like really resisted ever applying for awards because I think it's so hysterical when people say award winning, but it makes sense. Like, it's funny, but also it makes sense. Like, I for so long I wanted it that then it became a chip on my shoulder where then I was like, I'm going to eschew the awards.
That's what I do.
And
you don't enter an award show?
It's called fear of failure, Dave. I did. After a while, I was like, you know what? This could become a thing that I could just dig it on. But actually, it's probably good advice to tell people that, you know, applying for awards is actually a great way to get
it. Yeah. It feels good if you win.
Don't be like us. But you know what the thing that pisses me off is? You have to pay to apply, and then you have to pay to get the frickin' award. So it's like, where do we get something out of this? You know what I mean?
And I guess it's a lot.
It's
like, hey, it's just $150 per project. You're like,
A lot of money.
And then $300 for this plexiglass cube with like, you know, with some like marbles in it that says like you won. I don't know. It's just funny. But I have the first question. I have a big question for Andrea.
Oh,
okay, so on your bio, it says that you grew up in Maryland.
My dad
grew up in Maryland. And for all the Maryland listeners, you have the most fabulous accent. Do you know how to do that Northeastern kind of thing they do where they say water?
So my family, we're from like the DC area, and my family's all like Latin. And like we moved here when I was five. Whatever. So I always think I talk really weird. Like I don't talk right. And I say words weird because my family like is all English as a second language speakers. Mm. So I can't do like American accents well. But it's funny. And I'm a big Maryland girl. Where in Maryland is he from?
Kent Island area, Queen.
I should
know more. This is terrible. I need to call my father, obviously,
I know what you're talking about.
Did you watch Mayor of Easttown?
Because
Kate Winslet, who's an English actress, nails that Northeastern seaboard accent, which is the most strange accent. And they did an SNL sketch on it, which is hysterical. You have to look it up. But
is it like a Brooklyn accent?
No. It's like, but they say boot, like if oohs are like ooh.
It's almost like an English?
It's weird. It's almost like like the beginning of like America. It's almost like the English people came over and were like, let's rebel. Let's just do something real weird with this language, you know?
Let's talk weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating. Well, and you have to look it up.
I'm from like the DC suburbs, which is just not the same. You know, it doesn't have the same
totally
Maryland
different.
Charm.
Yeah.
As up where your dad's from.
Yeah.
Like so you guys have Maryland. A lot of money. How much money do you guys have? How much money does your dad make?
First question.
He doesn't. He's a construction worker. No, actually, I credit my dad for making me very creative because he always would, when we would visit him on summers, he would bring us to the job sites and we had two options. We could just sit in the truck or we could help him on the job site and like pick up trash and stuff and, you know, bring nails to the guys. And I always felt so empowered. Like I was like one of the crew, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, he taught me how to use like a power drill. And So I feel like that kind of, oh, you want to do it? Well, just do it, like figure it out, you know, was like very helpful actually, you know, and it's like when it came time to get my car when I was 16, I'm like, all right, Dad, I'm 16. He's like, cool, get a job. So he always instilled these very like good qualities of like, all right, you want it? You just got to put in the time and the effort and then you'll That's have awesome. It, you know?
Totally. Well, yeah, let's stay here for a second. Cause actually my first question for you was, you know, obviously like we've talked a couple of times just about growing a freelance career and like all of the fun stuff that we do, but I never really heard the full story of like how you got to where you are today. So, you know, maybe it started with your dad at the construction site, but can you tell us a little bit more about that journey that you went on?
Yeah, well, I wanted to be an artist. Me and my twin sister, we both grew up doodling. Like, we loved The Simpsons. We would always draw any characters we could. We thought we were going to be Disney animators, you know, like that was the dream. But then, you know, life happens. And then you end up in community college and you're like, damn, this stuff is expensive. And then you get jaded, as you do when you're, you know, 20. You get jaded and you start thinking like, I can't make any money at this, you know? And so I took one of those little aptitude tests that they have at career counseling, whatever. And it said, you should try graphic design. I literally had never heard of the term, which is kind of crazy because I was surrounded by it, but I think it wasn't cool. Like, you know, like the Kardashians made branding a household like name. I feel like they literally made everyone understand what branding was. They were always talking about it. But before that, I don't think people really, it wasn't as like common. So. You know, but anyways, so I took some graphic design classes, and then luckily my sister, who was working at a coffee shop, a guy who came in every day was looking for some, pretty much he was going to apprentice designers for this project that he was starting, which was a local like newspaper / coupon clipper. And so we were like, oh my gosh, we're skipping a step. Like we'll just stop taking classes and he'll teach us on the job, which was really incredible. And it's probably very rare that anyone can do that kind of thing this day, unless you're like a blacksmith or something. So he just taught us on the job and we just made coupons, like after coupons, after coupons. And for people who didn't have a logo except a JPEG that had been like resized and scaled down to like, it was 72 by 72, you know, pixels. So you had
that's the bottom. You like started at the literal bottom of graphic design and went to the top.
Oh, way bottom, yeah. Every time we do a talk, we always start with like our early portfolio. Not because it was terrible. It kind of had to be terrible. In order for ads to work, they have to be loud and ugly. Like, so it was effective design for the brief, but also it wasn't pretty. So yeah, it just...
I cut you off. Sorry about that. Keep going.
No, cut me off whenever. I find that makes better conversations. But anyways, so yeah, we were just doing coupon ads. And then...
So where did you...
The company folded. Yeah, the company folded pretty much, and we couldn't get hired because we had coupons in the portfolio, and then we just started our own thing.
That's about it. That's how it goes. That is crazy. Jeez.
That's all you want to tell us about your journey is you started with coupons?
Oh, I thought you had something to ask, Dave. I didn't want to just keep rambling on. No, okay, so that's...
No, I interrupted you because you said to interrupt you anytime. It was a bad joke.
Oh, I do apologize. Should have given you that laugh track when you needed it.
Totally.
To be honest, though, I am so glad that we started our own thing when we were younger. I mean, we were probably 23 or 4.
Wait,
25. We were 25. So the blind naivety when you are 25, you know, is very helpful for starting something that's going to be very hard and soul crushing.
That is how I live my life.
Yeah. No, I think so. If you are going to start your own freelance, I definitely count the costs first, do your budgets, like figure out what you need to do to make it work. But then you kind of, after you have set your mind to it, you kind of have to go in with some blind naivety too. Because like just over, and you can't be too precious. Pretty much over 2 weekends, we just like made a logo, made a website. And we had the necessity of needing to pay rent, which really helped us not be precious and not keep on like, you know, coddling it over 2 years and just telling everybody at parties we went to, it's still in the works, I promise, you know?
Yeah.
Necessity really is something good that helps you to just get things done.
Totally. No, yeah. That is exactly how I live my life.
Like a candle in the wind?
Yeah, I'm 22 years old and I just say, okay, I'm going to do this thing. And then I don't think about it until it happens. And then I'm like, wow, that was actually hard. And I should have thought about it a little bit more.
I always forget that you're 22 because you're, you know.
Wise beyond my years.
You are. No, you're way more like organized and you're smarter than me. Like it's There's all kinds of things that make you better than me, but
I always think
it's again, it goes back to when my parents would tell me just like, oh, you're a piece of crap. Remember I was telling you? No, I'm kidding, mom and dad. They're
in
greatest.
Case they must listen to this and be like, that ungrateful.
They're so nice. My mom is so nice. It's ridiculous. My dad used to have a temper, but as his testosterone has dropped, as he's like moving to his 80s, he's like
turned
the sweetest
into a teddy
guy.
Bear.
Yeah. But I forgot what I was going to say. I forget that you're like a child.
Yes, very much so. I like when people tell me that because I still feel like a child. So it's just a little bit validating. But like, okay, you're not wrong.
I do too, though. I feel like a kid, probably because I don't have children. Like, I don't have those normal, like, life marks that, like, signify when you become the adult in the room, you know? So I'm still like, we get to do whatever, right?
I mean, I would say owning an incredibly successful freelance company is basically that marker.
Yeah.
Thank you. It is weird. We hit 10 years this year, which
that's
I've been
wild.
Trying so hard to get something together to like commemorate it, to send out or promote, you know, but it's just client work has taken precedence. But it is really cool to look back. And I have been trying to think more about like those year marks of when things were like turning around, you know, because like for sure the first year was just like, we will literally do anything for any amount. And a lot of it was actually in trade. So it was like trade for things that we were spending too much money on anyways, trade for coffee, trade for food.
Totally.
And they were all with friends who, you know, couldn't justify themselves. And I still love doing trade with friends who I think are wildly talented. And for some reason, we both think we're too expensive for each other. Like my photography friends were like, I can't afford you. And I'm like, well, I can't afford you. So let's just trade instead of changing money, which is like the same thing. But
yeah, exactly. It works out.
It does. Yeah.
Instead of being like, here, you give me your money and then I'll hand it immediately back to you.
Right.
And pay you for your services. We'll just try.
Right.
Take out the middle step.
I didn't know that was a thing. I only know illustrators. Like you started your gig at the right time. I started mine in my 40s because I was an art director and creative director for 10 years. And then I was like, I'm going to draw pictures. And I moved on. And so I don't have that foundation of like cool designer, friend group, people to trade stuff with. But I want to trade stuff. I'll give you an illustration for some type design.
Let's do it. Let's trade for sure. Well, my gosh, I feel like you would have way more connects now from all your years in the CD world.
But they're like writers and creators. They're not fun people. Like, okay, Dave, we're going to hire you. They'll like hire me to do a mural for the agency they're now running.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. You must have some good connects for clients, though. That's cool. From all those years, you know?
I do. It's funny though, because they're my friends, and I realized this yesterday. Like I had a falling out yesterday, literally with an old friend who was also an old client. And after the falling out, because he's being a big jerk about these murals, and he's like, "Yeah, we're gonna do them earlier this year." And then he didn't say we weren't in the future. And then he said we're gonna do them earlier this year. I made it sound like we took a time machine. Earlier this year, he's like, we're going to do these murals. And then and he's like, we're not going to do them. We're going to do them in the fall. And so I hit him up and he was like, we put that money elsewhere. And I was like, oh, I wish you would have told me. Like, you could have told me that because I'm kind of depending on it.
Right.
He didn't like get back to me. Anyway, it turned into this texting thing where I eventually was like, dude, peace out. Mm. Which was super weird. But I wrote down, when I learned something, I write it down on my Wacom tablet, take a picture of it. And I wrote down clients aren't your friends.
It is true.
You can't make them your friends. You can be friendly and you can love each other, but you're not friends in the same way. Like, hey, buddy, can you give me a little more time? Or can you pay me? They're not your friends in that regard.
Right.
He really didn't owe me the job. But because we were friends, now he's a dick. You know what I'm saying?
Right. It is true. You have to set boundaries. And it's funny because some of your, like you mentioned, a lot of our friends turned into clients. And those are the ones that are harder to establish like mutual boundaries with. Mm-hmm. Although some of them still are my favorite clients to work with, because if they trust you intrinsically, usually that's why you keep working together.
Yep.
The ones, your friends that you kind of collaborate with and you kind of realize, oh, this isn't a good fit. They're not really holding up their end of the bargain. Like you kind of nicely just like, you know, peter out and like don't ever talk about it again. But but it's true. There's like an interesting power dynamic when you do run your own projects and you don't have a project manager, where you do have to keep a healthy level of like distance, you know, enough to where you can at least like present yourself as the one that they're hiring as the expert, right?
Yes.
There's that book, Win Without Pitching. You know, have you guys read that book by Blair Enns?
I don't read books. I'm naturally smart.
Okay. Well, you know, if you were to, you know, sleep on it and absorb it through osmosis, Dave, you would learn. I'm just kidding. But he does say this really interesting thing that, you know, it's so important to start out a project with the leadership power if you are the creative that they're hiring as the expert. Because the minute they start distrusting that you have it in hand, the minute they start grabbing the reins and trying to control it, and they don't know what to do because they aren't a creative and they aren't the one who's supposed to be leading the project. And the way you lose the power is when you flake, or when you don't show up, or when you don't meet those deadlines, or when you start using like language like, I don't know, what do you think? I mean, that immediately says, I'm not the expert, I need help, you know? Not like it's bad to ask for help, but there's just a way to do it. And it's as we've, you know, grown our business, we've learned more of that. At first, we used to just like, you know, laugh at like, you know, business books and self-help books, like, oh, you know, how lame, you know, because we were 25, you know, and we were just like, you know, flying by the seat of our pants. But late as you go on, you just realize there's so many nuances and to running a business, and almost all of it is the soft skills of just communication and people stuff.
Yeah. Totally. Gosh, that's such good advice. But it is, it's a razor's edge, and like, it's not a, it feels like a game, you know, when you're like, oh, I'm going to delete, like, emails take like 40 minutes, right? When you're, when you're just like, I got to be really careful here not to put the word in that's going to give them the reins. It's, and again, clients that are listening, we're not saying that, we're saying only good things about you, but it's,
well, the thing is that clients are so, like, they're so smart in the thing that they do. And that's the trade-off. You have to give them the respect that they know everything about their business, and they're hiring you to join in and to know everything that you know about your business. So there is like a negotiation there, where if they push back and say, well, that doesn't really accurately represent, you know, aluminum siding, because aluminum siding is really shiny and you made this whole thing really dull, then you have to believe them, you know, and take that for what it is.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. I had a great experience with Disney earlier this year, and it was good. And I told them this in an email because they let me do my thing. It was wild. They're just like, dude, whatever you think is. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I know you're saying that, but like, when are you going to come back with the feedback that's going to derail this whole thing? And the whole way through, they're like, dude, keep. No, it's fine. Like, there's no feedback. Seriously, keep going. I'm like, oh, okay. Like, are you sure? Like a guy who's like hungry, who's like trying to eat, and like, can I have this?
Right, right. Oh my gosh, that's amazing though. Yeah, like, especially with big clients like that, because usually the bigger the client gets, the more people are weighing in and the more risk there is, for obvious reasons. Like, there's just so much that they could lose if one little thing goes off. So they tend to be much more cautious, much more, you know, for obvious reasons or whatever. But that's why I've always loved the mix of, you know, a few medium to large size clients is always what you're going for when you're starting your own thing. You're always trying to get those clients. But then when you get there, you're like, I actually do miss those small clients where it was so much more like agile, and you can kind of just like do it kind of more quickly and more, I don't even know how to explain it, but so that mix is kind of nice. But you got that experience from a big client, which is always like the ideal, obviously.
Yeah, totally. It's great. But I at the beginning of the podcast, I always say enough about me because I just want to talk about today's guest, because I tend to do that. You know how people like when they don't
want to talk. It's narcissism. We understand. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm just going to take off. You guys can
finish. Yeah, go stare in your mirror.
Get you can't see it, by Jen, but he actually has a mirror over his screen right now. He's not even looking at us.
Yeah.
That's the only way you can get him to focus.
Yeah. Well, I can see you guys. Yeah, it's the mirrors are set up in a way where I can see you, but I see me first.
Yeah, right. Like, I would never focus.
Priorities.
On that.
Yeah, totally. Let's get back to the questions, because this is going to be like a really disjointed transition, because I have the next question, and I hope you have an answer to this. On a scale of 1 to 10, how good is the Nichrome font?
It's so good. I bought it. It was on Future Fonts for a while, right?
Yeah, this was a total shot in the dark. I think it's fantastic. And I was like, I bet Jen knows about this font.
No, I did. It's funny because I did buy it. I bought Nichrome and Roba, which Roba is a little bit, it's like a reverse, weight kind of, but they have somewhat similar vibes, but they're both incredible. And I bought Nichrome when it was on Future Fonts, and now I saw that he just moved it out of development into like full blown, like ready to use font kind of a thing. But
that's like $300
is great. I know. Yeah. And I got it like when it, I was like, yes, I totally beat the system. Got it when it was cheap.
It's so cool. I love that. I don't know if that's like a thing or if they're the first ones to do it, but it's so cool. You can buy a font for like $20 and then the person makes it to the end and gives you the updates for free. And then by the time it's done, it's like $400.
Right. Because fonts are one of those things that's interesting. I mean, you make it, there's so much work that goes into making a font. Like, I forgot, Bruno Mogg, he was on this font forum called Type Drawers, DRAWERS, if anyone's interested in type. You want to talk about real experts. Those guys are and women are incredible on there. Well, anyways, he said it on average, it takes him 100 to 150 hours to make a font. So, and I think I'm thinking he's meaning per style, not per family. So a lot of font makers, it's smart, like Future Fonts has people pay up front to kind of invest in early stage fonts before they're perfect, so that these font makers can kind of like grub stake the process.
It's one of those things that I have as like zero. I love fonts, I love type. I went to school for graphic design and then got into illustration, but I have zero desire to make. You make fonts, you guys sell fonts, correct?
Yeah, we do. We started out doing lettering, and then it was kind of a natural. Well, actually, a friend of ours that we met at a conference, he runs Retro Supply Co. And it pretty much, he asked Amy if she wanted to collaborate on a font, and they made one together. It was called Palm Canyon Drive. And when we saw how well that one went through his platform, we were like, oh, dude, we should try and do one for us. And we had never engineered one before, but Amy's my twin sister who runs Hoodspa with me, she is really good at like trying new things and exploring different skills. And she just learned Glyphs app, which is what we build the fonts in. Oh, cool. And if anyone's interested in lettering, Glyphs app is such a natural next step from Adobe Illustrator, surprisingly. And you get so much control over curves and stuff. So I don't want to nerd out too much in case non-designers
are listening. I didn't know that was a thing. I'm writing it down right now. Because I do type in my pieces, but just little moments. And it kind of, I probably need a better app.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I'm sure a lot of lettering artists out there, they start with, one piece, they might sell it as an art print or do it for a client. And maybe that client didn't buy out full rights. Well, if you really like it and it's really successful, you could, kind of segue that into the beginnings of a font. So, I mean, there's a little bit of a learning curve for sure. But once you get in there, now I make all my word marks in there for logos. The control is so much better. It's crazy.
Nice.
Because, when you're an illustrator and you have smart guides turned on and it's like, this is aligned. And then you zoom in and it's like 10 pixels off.
Yes.
You're like, Illustrator, what are you doing to me?
I don't, it's like based on math, and you like, do the command D to duplicate, and then you hit it again. And it's like, you're like, why are you moving like in fractions with every duplication? It's
so
math.
Strange.
It's like you're asking, it's like, what's 2 + 2? 4. What's 4 + 4? 8. What's 8 + 8? 20. You're like, no, it's not. Like, what are you doing?
But we love you, Adobe, and Closer and Closer would love to have you as a sponsor on this podcast.
100%.
I almost love Adobe. Adobe, I'm mad at them. I was they brought me on to help with the launch of the Illustrator on iPad. Jeez, Dave. And so they're like, yeah, give us feedback, and I'm like, you need a live paint tool in the app.
Mm.
Live
kind
paint
of like
is
the. Like kind of like a Fresco does for Adobe, but within Illustrator.
Yeah, like Live Paint. Nobody uses it because it's a fill tool.
Oh, a fill
tool. If you're drawing in Illustrator, you'll make a, say you're making like a dog face. You'll make like the snout, right? And then you'll make like the top of the head. But you might not want to make that one shape, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you might just want to be like, do it, and then lift your pen up and then start the head. And so if you don't have paths connected, which I don't because things have depth, which means lines are going everywhere, you can't fill that.
I get what you're saying.
So you need Live Paint. You can convert it and then fill it with whatever you want. And so they didn't listen to me on that. And I'm mad at them because they have the blob brush tool, which is a brush where you can draw stuff, but it doesn't make a path. It makes a shape. It's not. And so you can't fill that with anything because
it's
a shape. And it's like, guys, that's really stupid. You should make Live Paint and Illustrator. Like, it's fine.
Well, gosh, Dave, your enemy list is really growing today.
I've been using Adobe products since 2003. I'm really good at them, and I know what is stupid about them, and they know what's stupid about them. And I've told them over and over again.
I can just see your face printed out on the developer's wall, just like a hit list, you know, and Dave's number one enemy, public enemy number one.
I got the frickin'. So they took out the line tool in Photoshop. Like there's a tool that's just a line tool. You can just drag a straight line, right? That's how we do a lot of dimension stuff. They took that out and just made it vector. So you couldn't just do the raster one. Made it incredibly difficult. I made a post this long on their website.
Oh, dang.
It was like, I'm going to compare this to a race car. I'm Mario Andretti and you just changed my steering wheel. And they put it back in. The guy's like, okay.
Nice.
Props to Adobe then. They're trying to make it work. They're listening to the counseling that you're giving them. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's impressive. Okay. You made a change in the world. When you die, you can say, I made an impact on this great world of ours.
I am a big deal. I don't think anyone understands. No. So let's talk about big deals. Let's talk about Chutzpah Design.
Natural.
Yeah, that was a good segue.
I was so nervous about today because I'm a huge fan of you guys and you scare me. You're incredible. You took like
twins.
I do
scare Dave.
I live in Utah and you guys did a job for Child's Dentistry.
Yes.
Place
called Poppy Tooth.
Yeah. You know, like that's how much I need to fear. You'll come into my territory and be like,
right.
Oh, babe, you do
steal
murals?
Your clients.
Yeah, like we're going to do this. We're going to do it. And I'm like, okay, it's fine. You can do it.
Whatever you want.
When I went on your site and saw that, I was like, huh.
How
I do murals. But yeah, by the way, did you guys design that whole place? Because it is so freaking cool.
It's amazing. So his name is Dustin Lockie and his wife, oh shit, then I'm blanking on her name. I'm having a very bad day today. But I worked with Dustin more closely on a previous brand project is why I remember his name so well. And then Tyler Hanks is the dentist. Well, anyways, Dustin's a designer and he helped them do all of their environmental design with his wife, Mrs. Lockie, I'll call her. And then the design of it's incredible. And they're already going to move to some locations in LA and Southern California too. Yeah. So it's really neat. But that's one of those things where sometimes the clients that write in, you know, it's like, hey, we're a dentistry office and we want you all to brand us. Like, I'm sure a lot of people would read that and be like, oh, that's not the quote unquote fun or cool project, you know? But
because
we had that connection with Dustin from working on a startup with him before, I was like, oh, Dustin was amazing to work with. They give you the freedom to do like, you know, great vision. Visionary work kind of stuff. I called my work visionary, please.
No, I was thinking the same thing though. It really is. Like I hold it as a high example of one of the coolest projects I've seen in a long time because of the industry it's in.
Exactly. So I think that was what was really exciting. It's like, oh, okay, so this is a client that does something that you wouldn't expect to be fun. The dentist is literally my worst fear. Like that drilling sound in, that you can hear in your skull. Like, please, no. But so when I thought about that and I remembered going to get braces at this orthodontist that had a giant ship in the office that you could play in, I was like, this is what we need more of, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, like making stuff that shouldn't be fun or cool, like turning it on its head, that always interests me as a project, you know? So sometimes you will take on work, you know, just because, you know, the premise is just too interesting. And they did. They wanted to make, like, they put a half-court basketball court in the kids' dentistry office. I'm just like, and I mean, I don't know if you guys all follow, there's this thing called Project Backboard where they have all these artists paint murals on basketball courts in like underserved areas. Yeah. So it makes it this kind of like thing to be proud of in your community. Dave, you should do one. Your work would look killer on a basketball court. I'm saying this like you have control, but you should reach out to them is what I'm saying.
Well, you know how powerful I am. I get tools right. Put back into Photoshop. No, but I'm lame because I'm a digital muralist.
But all their stuff you can tell is like, I think it starts as vector and then they hire a team to then translate it onto the court. Yeah.
Like Colossal. Colossal paints what you draw.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's like those teams in LA that make those photorealistic you know, billboards for movies still on the sides of buildings. Those
so cool.
Crews like blow my mind. It's insane. If you all want something that to really inspire you, look up old scene designers from like the 40s and 50s. I have to send you all this link to put into the show notes. There's this whole blog dedicated to it. And these people would, they paint on glass and then they would put it in front of the, you know, camera to make it look like it was like this real background. Yeah. Like in Citizen Kane, all of the things of the house on the hill. Anyways, anyone who is interested in art and design, the way they used to do graphic effects was so incredible and like wild for that time. Ugh.
Like that's so cool. Is that different than like matte painting, or is it in the same category? Because that's like a special effect you're talking about, right?
Yeah, it might be the same thing. I probably just don't know the correct term.
I don't know either. All that stuff, it's a lost art form. It's like why we can't go back to the moon because we forgot how to build.
Isn't that insane?
Oh my gosh. All the people died and all the manuals got burned and all the molds got destroyed. So we had to figure out how to build a spaceship again. Same thing with these lost arts you're talking about. Like they're going to go wrong.
It really is. It's incredible. That's why everyone should consider writing a how-to manual about something. Mm-hmm. I firmly believe that everybody has enough knowledge to write something about something, even if it's just an online guide. Because, like, you know, we wrote our book on how to freelance because people kept asking us, how did you get started? And we never thought we really knew that much. We just literally Googled or, you know, eavesdropped in on friends who knew more, things like that. But, you know, we kind of gathered enough to kind of figure it out on our own. And so we figured, well, let's just make a quick little ebook of everything we thought we should have, we wished we would have known at the beginning in a way that's like actually not totally overwhelming to digest. It made exactly for creatives. So we did it and we like put it up on our site and then didn't tell anyone about it. That's how embarrassed we were that it would be wrong. But if people would reach out specifically and say, how'd you start your business? We would just point them there. Well, eventually a student from the local Laguna College of Art and Design found it and asked us to come speak to his class. And so we went and gave a little talk to the class, and the dean of design was there. Her name's Catherine Ure. She's amazing. And she was like, oh my gosh, you all know way more about this than I expected, you know, because you talk really high and really fast, like, you know, like 12-year-old girls, because we've never grown out of this, our weird like California Valley speech. Anyways, so she asked us to teach professional practices at LCAD. And that during that period when we taught there, we kind of honed the content and then re-released it like officially as like a book we were really like proud enough of to actually market. And that has become, between that book and the course that we made off of that book, it's become 20% of our income, which we don't really have to think much about. It's already done. We just have to keep like reminding people it exists, you know?
That's so cool.
Yeah. And I never set out to be a writer, any of that kind of stuff. Like sometimes income streams like that can kind of hit you out of nowhere. You just have to listen to what people want from you and see if you can give it to them, I guess, you know?
Yeah. That's a huge one. Listening to what people want from you. I refuse to make prints and that's all people want. And so I'm starting to come around to that idea. I interrupted my own question like 10 minutes ago and I really want to ask you this stuff and you're kind of speaking to it now. But I look at designers and places like Chutzpah to remind myself, you got to give the people what they want. That's you're not being uncool if you do that. Like they're like you, they want this stuff.
Yeah. Well, what's so interesting. Like when you're working for yourself, whether you're an illustrator or whatever you're doing, you know, you kind of think of your main client at like 101 is the people that you're designing for or illustrating for, right? But beyond that, there's this whole other category of people who eventually, if they really like what you're doing, are your peers who want to know how you're doing what you're doing.
Yes.
And you can either be stingy and scared about it and say, why would I train up my competition? Or you can realize that in 10 or 15 years, you're going to be really tired of doing this anyways. And you can either be the one who's still fighting to get clients, or you can start kind of positioning yourself as some sort of an expert who, you know, you kind of have that second income stream by helping other people do what you've kind of figured out for yourself, you know? And there's so many different ways to do things that there's, even though there's a million books out there on how to start these things, I was shocked that anyone would want yet another one. But just because there's other people who've done it doesn't mean that there shouldn't be another one that's done better. It's just like how Stance came out, Stance Socks. It's like, who needs more socks? And yet Stance came out and they did it different. So it's like, you can't think that just because it exists, it shouldn't be done again.
That's true. It's Instagram was like, well, remember Hipstamatic?
Right.
They're like, we're not going to make sharing a thing. We're going to make, you know, the phone, the new camera. And they're like, you can't share your photos? Like, no. And then Instagram's like, cool. Well, we'll do the same thing. We'll take your filters and we'll make sharing a thing. And then we'll sell it to Facebook. Hipstamatic. One of the great. Yeah. It's like the picture of the Zeppelin, the Hindenburg burning and falling. We have that, right. And then we have Hipstamatic. People don't realize that's modern Hindenburg. Anyway,
that's like, so, I was watching a documentary the other day about Blockbuster Video and how they almost had Netflix beat. Yes. So, yeah. But then they got this new CEO who came in who at the same time bought Circuit City. So, you know, his mind was on the total wrong track because he was thinking he could save Circuit City. So, and he said, oh, this streaming, this, you know, online and streaming thing's not going to go anywhere. So he shut it down right as mm-hmm. Netflix was offering to buy their subscribers for $1 billion. So it's just like, you see these things in hindsight and you're just like, dang, we, there's this great podcast called Revisionist History by Malcolm Gladwell, where he looks back at things that we thought were truths and actually reveals how it's like media just kind of framed its own, you know, a story based on the half facts that they had. It's so fascinating.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I love that podcast. And I love Circuit City. And I think he was right. No,
How are your stocks doing for Circuit City?
They're not great. They're not great right now. They're zero. The last Blockbuster, is that the documentary?
It wasn't that one. It was actually really like, it was kind of a more low budget one. It was like Netflix versus Blockbuster. One of those like really like underground ones on Amazon Prime. They have a lot of
beautiful.
So do you put stuff on in the background as you work, stream it as you work?
I do, unless I have to be in a certain mode. Most of the creative decisions have to have been made. I have to be kind of plug and chug mode. Otherwise I'll get distracted.
Exactly. I'm 100% with you. When I'm doing line work and I just know I'm going to be drawing after all the things have been done. So like 20 minutes ago, I interrupted my own question. But let's jump back to the book. So, what are like the key areas of focus for you guys when you first started? Because there's a reason why Chutzpah is where they're at and other designers are where they're at. And let's be honest, you guys are more successful than the average designer. And I have to believe that's because what you guys decided to focus on from the beginning. So it's kind of a four-part question, but what were like the key areas of focus? And then did those shift? And if they did, what did you have to sacrifice that you didn't expect? And also, if these are values, why are they valuable?
Okay.
40-part question.
Okay. Remind me of these as I go through them because I might lose the thread.
Absolutely.
But so at first, like I said, and I don't think there's anything wrong with this, the first goal was make money. And we did. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really great to have values 100%. I'm not saying like, do anything shady, but I mean, as a business, you do have to kind of first and foremost think, how do I cover my expenses?
Totally.
So step number one was literally making a budget and planning out. And I would say if anyone's planning or even remotely interested in working for themselves, start saving now. Literally start figuring out what is 3 months worth of expenses that you have. Figure out how much that is and divide it up and create a savings plan. Because if you want to freelance, like you need to have that money ready when you're ready to get going. And you're not ready now to freelance, but you will be it someday, right? So we didn't have savings. So our first goal was to build up savings because with savings comes the power to make choices. Before that, we just kind of took on literally whatever we could and to get, money in the door. So once we had savings built up, we were like, okay, now we can be a little bit more picky choosy. And so that's when we actually had to train ourselves to say no, because we were saying yes to everything. And we had to try and make space to curate the kind of, work we wanted to get. We had been doing that through passion and personal work, and showing the kind of work we wanted to get, which everyone knows that's kind of a 101. But we were like, now we can actually do it hopefully through client work. So that was like the next phase was like, trying to actually get the clients, the dream clients. Then the next phase was realizing that a lot of our dream clients that did interesting things didn't really pay the bills. And that was because they were like us. They were young with great ideas, but, maybe didn't have as much funds, which was fine. We still love doing that, but we realized, okay, so now we actually have to do some of the stuff that we used to rail against, boring corporate work. Yeah. And so we're like, we actually need to expand our portfolio to show that we can do normal stuff. So we worked on that. I think we just looked at it a lot more pragmatically than maybe, we grew up in Kentucky and my grandma ran her own store with, her husband. And I think it's just always been a lot more pragmatic for us. So it's not like, does this make me happy? Which, of course, that should be a goal. But I think at the end of the day, we kind of always knew yes, we want this to make us happy and be something we're proud of. But at the same time, we want it to be successful too. So there's a lot. We have every year we would make a document where we looked back, itemized what we made, how we made it. And then we made goals and plans for who we wanted to reach out to the next year and how we wanted to make our money. And it's weird how just enunciating what you want, because at first it's all like gut instinct in your stomach, especially for creatives. You kind of just are acting off of like instinct. So when you write it down, you realize like what you really want and what you thought you want that you actually don't. And so, you know, it just kind of helps you at least move towards something, right? And it is weird how many of those things ended up kind of coming about because we started focusing on them actively, you know? So... but yeah, as far as values, a lot, we have always been interested in making our own stuff on the side. And I think a lot of creatives are like that. And at first, of course, it was prints and t-shirts that no one bought. Literally every creative thinks they can start a brand, which, and some of them do. I'm always shocked, like Sam Bergini, people like him who is, and his partner, who just put out like amazing stuff, or like Monsters Outside. I've got one of his t-shirts on, but it's like power to you if you can. But like, I'm going to be honest with you, don't start a brand. Like we started one with Odds and Sods just to see if we could. It was a great learning experience. We did make it somewhat profitable, but the amount of work it took was not worth it in the end. So we still do passion projects on the side all the time, though. That was what the book was. That was what fonts were, you know, and all those things started out being like just more like for us, you know, on the side.
Yeah.
But eventually we worked them up to being profitable. Like, you know, fonts used to only make up like 1% of our income, and now they make up 10% of our income. So we're slowly building that, you know. And you do have to kind of know the difference between making things for like visibility and then making things for profit. So our services have always been like, this has got to be mostly for profit. And then our products have a lot more often been like, let's just grow our name and our, like, you know, sell things or give things away that remind people we exist. A lot of our products started out as client gifts, you know? So I think I answered some of those things along the way.
You totally did. And like, I hope that anyone listening is starting to get a picture of how like organized you have to be. Like you guys have everything like organized and packaged and put on like a particular area on the shelf. You're like, this is where we make our money. This is where we have our fun. This is the kind of clients we need to go after. Like you really have to. And what I admire about you guys, this takes a lot of time outside of designing, the thinking, categorizing, and the pursuing and the goal making, and then going after those things. And this job really is not about making art. It is, but it's like a very small portion of the time, and running the business takes just as much time sometimes.
Yeah. It can be a 50-50 thing. And at first I was like, what are we doing? We're spending so much time running our business. This can't be right. And then you start to realize like in some, I mean, there's really no way to get beyond. I mean, some people might have worked out a way to do 70-30 and 30% of their time is spent running their own business. But when you work for yourself, I mean, I think you have to kind of get used to and start learning to enjoy that part. Otherwise, you kind of are always just a little bit jaded. But early on, we always thought, oh, Hudspeh's going to be a giant agency one day, like Pentagram. Like we thought that's what we wanted to do. Well, we hired two people, which were amazing. Julie MacBoyce and Andy. Oh, how funny. They were both Boyces, but spelled different. Anyways, they're both Boyces. How have I never put that together? That's funny. We have a thing for Boyces apparently. And they were at different times. And then we had interns. We had like two or three interns because we thought that would be fun. And we realized, oh my gosh, now we're spending 100% of our time managing. Like now we really are not having fun. So we also learned early on that you don't have to be giant to get big clients. You just have to build up your reputation like those giants did. And you have to really do the, make the time to like, you know, build your own brand up. You have to, and we've never submitted for awards, but we have submitted for stuff that's equally scary, like brand new under consideration, review sites that review different designs and things like that. And just trying to kind of build our name in different worlds. So
that's magic right there. So I always look for that thing in anything. It's like, where's the magic trick? Like you have Pentagram over here who's hiring like the best designers in the world and doing amazing stuff. Hudspeh who's like doing the same thing, right? But it's two people. Because you guys realized the magic trick, which is build the brand. Don't necessarily have to build the
team.
The team, yeah.
Right. And we do. That's magic. So now there's four of us. There's me and Amy who are like, you know, the kind of for the creative, like the branding side. There's us. And then Arturo Jimenez is our graphic designer who does a lot of like building out systems, you know, once the brands are established, you know, and that kind of thing. And he's amazing at that. And then our other sister, B, she kind of is like office manager and runs the shop side. And so it's kind of worked out nicely. So four is about like the max we can manage. And Arturo, to be honest, manages him himself. He's incredible. And he's been with us for 8 years. So, you know, if it so, but anyways, it is interesting. There's another book called Studio of One, which I've been meaning to read, but it's pretty much all about how you can still do incredible high level work, even as a studio, a person of one. And there's so much less risk involved. It's so easy to think, I want to be that big company. And then we realized, oh, we would have to like buy an office that we all have to go in from 9 to 5. That's what we were trying to escape. Like, I don't want to have to open the doors and, you know, talk to people who walk in off the street and want a business card. And like, you know, so we like that it's agile and small. So we kept it that way kind of intentionally.
That's so cool. Intentionally. Yeah. Well, and I think this is a good, I mean, obviously, again, Jen, you've brought us right up into our next question, which is awesome. But, and I didn't know that that B was also your sister. That's really funny. But, you know, something that we're really big about here at Closer and Closer, obviously we're also a really small team. I think there's like 7 or 8 of us total. But we're really big on like bringing people together to accomplish more than they could on their own. And I think that's like a lot of what you've just been talking about is like, it is really hard to run the whole business and also do all the creative. And like, you do need to get other people involved at some point, or, you know, it might be beneficial. How did you go about choosing like the people that you brought into Hoodspell? Obviously, like 2 of them are your sisters and you have Arturo, but like, what are those qualities that really stood out to you in them that made you be like, okay, yeah, like this is a good person to bring in? And also, I'm just curious, what is it like working so closely with 2 of your sisters? And like, how did you guys decide to do this together? Or was it just kind of like always, I don't know, like how was that born? It seems really interesting to me. Well, I have a lot of sisters, so.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's fine.
I do not want to work with any of them.
Well, me and Amy being twins, and our mom was so strict with us, like we would get paddled if we even said like shut up to each other. So we've always, and we moved around a lot. So we've always been really close because we were like built-in allies when we moved to a new city. So I think we've always gotten along really well, even though like we'll blow up and like have a like a fight. You remember Fantastic Mr. Fox, how the animals all of a sudden would go feral and start like, like we'll just do that for 2 seconds to get it over with and then be like, sorry. And then we're done, you know? So in some ways I like it because we can be very honest with each other in a way that you would hope with creative partners. And then in some ways we actually had to teach her, like be very careful to like respect each other more than we would if we were just sisters. So, because we're business partners. But anyways, and then our little sister, she was nannying. So, and she, it was just like very exhausting as much as she loved it. And we were like, dude, come in and help us with our shop. And so that was just actually her doing us a favor. but, and then Arturo, I always look for creatives to collaborate with who seem like flexible, eager to help with anything. And they have a really good variety of skills because, and I know that that's, it's not always right for everybody, but he was great. He had a really good attitude that just kind of was like, I just want to like, you know, try new things and help out. And he had a great portfolio. So we both loved The Simpsons, which is really weird, but we just seemed to connect on a few different levels. And, you know, we kind of need someone who's kind of like us, who is willing to do like not so fun stuff and fun stuff. And if you're the person who's trying to get a job, who's like only wants to work on the top profile stuff, it's actually harder for you to find that position because like people are looking for someone who's like willing to just like get their hands dirty and help out, you know, and not be picky choosy. So, so drop the entitlement at the door, I would say is your first objective.
Piece of advice.
But as far as like outsourcing and finding people to collaborate with, you know, I probably kept on to like bookkeeping way too long, things like that. But I still do like our contracts and like, you know, our invoicing and stuff like that, just because like, I know it better and I can just, now I'm so used to it that I'd rather just like, get it over with when I want it done. But a lot of people have written in and be like, are you hiring? But we don't hire anymore. We're not building, but I do love referring people work. And I have the most giant epic board of referrals because I think like, as we grow in our notoriety, we aren't able to take on near, you know, and as much as comes in. So I love referring out to other people. And I think that's something that we can all do for each other as creatives is remember to like hook our friends up when it can't be us, you know? When we're in Feast, you know, helping other people out, when they're in Feast, helping us out and that kind of thing, because Feast and Famine is real. So it is crazy, 100%. Like how much work we've gotten from other creatives. And I think that's something that's underlooked when you are a freelancer or trying to find your own clients is like, subcontracting for agencies is such a huge gold mine. That really, they take a lot of the hard work out of it for you. They get great clients. So we still reach out sometimes to other agencies, like really large ones, you know, or really anyone who might sub us for certain things. And then, you know, photographers refer us a lot of great work, and we'll refer stuff their way because we have, like, you know, kind of like skills that like help each other but aren't in direct competition. So those are kinds of creative peers that are great to keep in contact with.
Totally.
Absolutely.
No, yeah. That's definitely something we try to do as much as we can here at CNC too, is like, oh, we definitely can't do this, but like, here's this other great person that can. And I think it just also like really helps your client relationships. Like at the end of the day, you know, your clients are going to appreciate that so much more than you trying to have to do a project that you don't have like either the bandwidth or the skills to do. Like they're going to appreciate it so much more and be so much more likely to come back.
Yeah. That's also nice to have, like, there's only a few of us on the roster who are dumb enough to draw way too many things and put it in their pieces. And so, we'll just like pass, like, if I can't do something, I'm like, here, Alejandro, you literally do what I do, but better. Here you go. Like, and there's only a handful of us. So we're lucky that way. Cause if no one else can do it.
Dave, your stuff is so cool though, because I feel like you should do a Where's Waldo books of types, you know, because like you can do these worlds where you could, or remember Highlights Magazine, they would have the two pictures and one side has more stuff in it than the left and you have to like figure out what's missing or what's different.
Yeah.
Like,
differences.
I'd buy that stuff from you.
It's funny. I get hired with like the emails like, hey, we're kind of doing a Where's Waldo thing. And I will like 100% of the time say no.
Really?
Because, yeah, I'm surprised that the clients don't see this when they look at my stuff. I've done two pieces that kind of look like Where's Waldo, and it's led to a lot of pain because you have to draw so much stuff.
I'm shocked. Yeah.
I'm an art director at first. And so like, I don't know why I expect people to understand this. I need to explain it better. My pieces are things that I want to hold in my hands that don't exist in the world. And I just place them. And I think scale is so important. Like, so I draw huge isometric things. Like I'll draw like 18 things and put them together. Whereas Waldo's like 490 things.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm like the mid range.
That's true, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, your stuff is like, I mean, that's an endeavor. Power to you. That's impressive.
So it's kind of the worst thing. I was thinking of the other question I'm going to ask, but I'm going to let, you know, make sure that, wait, Andrea, is it?
Go for it.
Are we there yet?
Go for it, Dave. Yeah, we're there.
Yeah, we are there. Actually, yeah, this leads in the next question. I was thinking about this current project I'm working on. I'm like, gosh, it's so dumb how I can't, like, there's a point in my process. Well, you never know first if a project's going to be good. Eventually it becomes good. And you just have to have faith that that's going to happen. And there's a point where that all clicks, right? And I don't know the science behind it. And I'm hoping that you do a little bit. The one I'm currently working on, I realized this week I have to draw the thing and put it next to all the other stuff to see if it fits. A sketch won't do it. And I'm like, how can I not visualize it? Like, why can't? And so it's actually this huge burden so I have a whole library of stuff I don't use. B-sides, if you will.
Right.
But in your experience, design is this process of failure and then half successes, and then you eventually like achieve full success, right? It's kind of what I'm getting at. And I was just explaining that my failure is just harder to deal with because I actually have to finish a thing and then throw it out.
That's the worst.
Yeah. And that's why I compare it to safe cracking, is because it's like, no, that didn't work. You actually have to go to the number, right?
Yeah.
So we have this sixth sense as designers and illustrators to know when something isn't there yet, right? And like, we have to keep pushing it. Do you have a project or an example that you could share with us where like it just was going terribly and then something clicked? Or does this happen every time? Something clicked.
Oh, every time. Literally
every time. It happens every time?
Yeah, yeah.
Go for it. We'd love to hear some tales because I think this is a really important part to learn. Like, it's always going to go terrible, but there's always something that happens throughout the process that makes it good.
Yeah, 100%. I think the minute the first, like, everyone always asks, like, how do you avoid creative burnout? I think your first step is to realize, like, it's going to happen, and it'll happen often. And it'll happen at the most inopportune time. And it might not be creative burnout completely, but it could be a roadblock, a creative block. You know, those are always the big questions that always get asked. I just kind of know that I need to have a certain window of time to account for that happening, because it will. Because I always start out like super amped. I'm like, oh, I have all these great ideas. And, you know, you see it in your head, and then you try and start executing it. And like you said, you have to get the ideas out to see that which ones won't work, which ones totally failed, which ones you have to scrap. And then inevitably you spend way too much time trying to make something that's not working work, and it still doesn't work. Yep. But that's just part of the process. Like, it's literally something you can't avoid, I don't think. It's just like, you know, unless you're just one of those people who, like, you just, every song's a hit, you know, but like you, even people like Celine Dion, or, you know, who's like, or like masters of, like, or Michael Jackson, like, they all have like songs that were just like, how did this make this on the album, you know? And you have to get those out, because first of all, sometimes you don't even know the stuff's bad. You know how it's like, as designers and artists, we always like the thing that everyone else won't like. It's almost like we're just so tired of doing what we know people will like that we kind of subconsciously want to do weird things. So I think part of it is just like, you have to have that community or those people in your life that you can talk honestly with, and just text them or Slack them and say, hey, this is where I'm at. It sucks, right? How do I fix it? You know, and get some honest feedback. And that's like so key. So, you know, having Amy, and then we have a Slack channel for our for our freelance and business course. And it's all creatives. And I go in there a lot to ask for feedback, which is great. So first you just like feedback from outside sources, and then just having the time to recharge. So for our logo designs, like, we always, that first logo proof, there's 2 weeks between when we do the discovery and then when we present the first logos. Because we need that much time to try everything, throw away what sucks, and then winnow in on the stuff that does work. So as far as specific examples, like, it's weird because it's almost like having a baby, or so I've heard, where it's like after the pain is over and something goes well, you kind of forget the pain. Like, that's true. Almost can't remember. There's a few things that have gone completely off the rails, and it's just been a bad client relationship where it wasn't so much that it was anyone's fault. It was more that the client changed what they wanted in the middle. Yeah. And I think that was a point where we learned, oh, like, sometimes it's just okay to say, hey, we're no longer a right fit for it looks like what you want. Like, based on what we initially agreed on, we would have been, but not anymore. And you kind of almost have to have an honest talk, like the honest breakup with the client. And usually they'll be like, no, like, let's try and make it work, because, you know, they're hoping that they can just finish it out. But we just had to be honest with them and say, look, this is what you wanted. We gave you that. You can see from the mood board and what we gave you, it actually was really on brief. So it looks like you just want something different now. And that's okay. But we're just not that person anymore.
Yeah. No, I'm glad that you kind of put that in a general sense. I changed the question when I was writing it, because I was like, oh, this, I'm being too vague. Like, you know, when does the project become good? But you're totally right. Like, it is. You said it. It's unavoidable. This happens every single time.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I feel not as alone in the universe right now, because when you're going through the trial of like, why isn't this working? Like, do I suck at this now? Am I never going to nail the brief? Like, that happens to every single artist, designer, creative.
And it's so true.
Yeah.
And it's so important to have those people who outside of you can say, no, you've got this. You can. What you're doing now, it's not right, but just throw it away and keep going, you know? And that's almost always the solution. That's why I think it's really dangerous to wait for inspiration to strike. To be honest, a lot of what we do as creatives, I know that it is like kind of intangible, but there's such importance to just putting in the time and setting like a healthy, like repetitious kind of like just time to just work, right? Because it is, it's work. So even if you're not feeling inspired, still do the 9 to 5 or at least 9 to 3, whatever, and still try at it, because you have to get those wrong answers out before you're going to get the right one, you know?
Absolutely. There's a nice common thread there with, again, I'm sorry I keep putting you on a pedestal. I really believe that you guys are like some of the best designers in the world right now. And
oh, stop. No,
I know it's hard. That's hard to hear. It's just as hard to hear that, like, sometimes a compliment is as painful as as an insult.
It's true. What is that?
I don't know. It's odd. It's just like, no, don't, because then something bad will happen, or it won't be true, and then I'll be let down. But the abstract episode with Christoph Nyman. He's the guy who does what's it called? He does the sketches on Sunday. He'll get like a banana, and then he'll put it on a piece of paper, and then he'll put it and draw something. Well, I shouldn't use a banana as an example for drawing things around. He'll like, he does these cool things on windows, actually, with like a pen where it looks like a guy stepping over the city. He's like huge.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I'll have to look that up. I'm so embarrassed. I haven't seen the abstract series. Like, what kind of creative am I? Yeah.
I can't believe it. No, then it just goes to show that great minds think alike, because he talks about having to just go into the office or his little workspace in Berlin and stare at the piece of paper and do the work.
Like, right.
Can't wait for inspiration.
Right. It's like the blank page is the scariest thing. So just put something on there. It doesn't matter if it sucks. Well, and you know, Aaron Draplin's, you know, he is so interesting because he'll do his workshops. And I saw one time where he does the logo workshops and he's working so rapid fire and he's not perfecting it. He's just doing one quick concept and then he option drags, make a copy, changes it. Option drags, makes a copy, changes it. He's going really rapid fire. And I think when you first start on a project, just like start, just go and make ugly stuff, make much ugly stuff. Like, just don't be precious with it. That's the best advice I could give.
Oh, it's so true. I wish there was a version of that for illustration. I was working on a little mountain last night inside this person's head, and each curve like matters. Like, I so admire illustrators who are like, oh, I don't care about perspective, and I don't care about the line quality. Unfortunately, again, I chose the worst style. It's all got to be perfect and. So I just need to get better at drawing, but, not being precious that is such a huge thing for designers. I know what you're talking about, the Draplin thing where he's just like, that guy is so good at coming up with solutions because it's manual labor. He's like, well, how do you think I'm going to come up with it? Like, am I going to stare at this thing and then have
the idea?
He's
another one. Yeah.
In a copy?
Who sees it as, it's just like a trade almost. He sees it more as a trade, which I think it's kind of healthy to see it that way sometimes when you're stuck. And then when you're, you know, less stuck, you can think of it more in the kind of, it's purpose and meaning. You know, but like finding something outside of your creative skill that gives you like purpose and meaning is so critical, because when you have those bad days when things aren't working, you know, it can be really easy to be like, oh, I should just quit and go work at Starbucks, you know, but.
Yeah, sometimes I think I'll just be a dad, but then I won't have any money.
Jen, I don't want to keep you for too long. I know we've been rambling about for a while, so I think I'm going to wrap us up with the hardest question of the whole hour. I know this one's a really tough one every time. Where can the people find you? Where can they go to see more of your work? Hudzpah's work.
Hudzpahdesign.com. HODZPAH. You guys should hear me when I spell out our name on the phone to, like, you know, people at the bank or stuff like that. They're like, what?
What the hell is that?
Excuse me? I'm like, just listen to the letters. P is in ball.
Trust me.
They don't want to believe it. Yeah.
No. Yeah. I have like the most complicated last name of all time. And it's always a horrible time trying to get people to understand what I'm saying over the phone. So
right.
I feel your pain.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Jen. This was so wonderful. I'm so happy.
Oh my gosh, so fun. Yeah. Love Closer and Closer. Everything that you and the whole like roster does is always just like stellar. Oh,
thank you.
Thank you.
We are big fans. I do all of it as well.
It's all thanks to Dave.
Yeah, it's actually so all many Dave styles. Secretly. He just puts different names on it, so it's not weird, but it's all Dave actually.
That would be a great ploy.
Awesome. Right? Well,
Jen, it was great talking to you. Thank you so much.
All right, talk to y'all later. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to the Closer and Closer podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review to receive the latest episodes. You don't want to miss some of the incredible conversations that we have coming up. They'll be full of powerful insight to help you reach your full creative potential. To find out more about us, visit www.closerandcloser.co.